No one will hear you scream in a far-off endoscopy unit where two people try to remove a bolus and it drops into the trachea. You really need to be experienced in order to do that.
Welcome to the ESGE podcast, Endoscopy Unplugged. Join us each month to hear the latest from European experts and where we'll discuss relevant clinical topics and provide you with tips and tricks, practical scientific evidence, and pearls of wisdom to inform your endoscopy practice. So please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and join us as we advance GI endoscopy care.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 4 of ESG's podcast, Endoscopy Unplugged. My name is Ian Grelnick, past president of the ESGE, and I am your host. Today's podcast is titled, That's Not Supposed to Be There, the Food Impactions Playbook. And my guest is Dr. Henriette Heinrich, who is the head of endoscopy at the Clarinus Abdominal Center at the University of Basel in Basel, Switzerland. Welcome, Henriette, to the podcast.
Thank you, Ian, for having me. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Now, before we get started with the podcast, I do want to ask you, how did you get into endoscopy? How has that become the main focus of your clinical practice?
I'd started pretty early during a rotation I did into endoscopy, where I was allowed to actually work the biopsy forceps. And it was love at first sight because I could diagnose with my eyes. I could take a biopsy. I could look at it under histology and then make a decision. So that's what drew me in.
Okay, very cool. So you fell in love with biopsy forceps first.
Yeah, with doing something, with being able to do something during endoscopy, and the biopsy felt very, very invasive at that time.
Very invasive. Okay, yeah, and look where we are today. So let's talk about food impactions. So you're on call. You get a call from the emergency department. Somebody came to the ER that they were out having dinner. They were eating steak, and all of a sudden things got stuck. So let's first talk about assessment and triage. So what first of all is your, what are the red flags that you're worried about when you first hear this story?
So I would definitely look at the general status of the patient. How old is the patient? Anticoagulants, heart, pulmonary disease. And I think the first question I'm asking is, can the patient still swallow his or her own saliva? And that very much directs what I'm going to do next. I'm in the privileged position that I have a registrar who goes and checks on the patients, whether they have skin emphysema, if they're in real discomfort. You can already see whether you need to go in, because if these patients can't swallow and have a real distension, esophageal pain, you can see it from the door and you know that you need to get active. What you also ask the patients if they've had it before. I think that's crucial. And what is also very important is what kind of meat. I always ask that, because then you know whether it's going to be that feathery chicken stuff or that compact venison. Venison can get very, very dry. And also how long they've been waiting. I think that is also something that directs my strategy, because some patients are really reluctant to go to the ER and wait for a long time. And if it's 24 hours or more, then you really need to be careful and watch out what you're going to do next.
Did you get ENT or head and neck surgery involved before you get there?
So that depends on your patient pathways according to your hospital. In our hospital, if they say it's stuck in the throat, our ER physicians will automatically call ENT, which is most of the time not successful. Then they see the saliva pooling up there, and then they say, well, you need to go to gastro.
So I know this is not a straightforward question, but then what determines your timing of when you're actually going to drop the gastroscope to take a look there and try and take care of this, what sounds like a food bolus that's impacted?
So as I said, if the patient cannot swallow, I think you need to go in within the next couple of hours. Even more so if the patient has been suffering for a long time, because okay, then that is quite crucial. And being able to swallow and to swallow water is usually something, then you should move to endoscopy. And the next decision is whether you need airway support.
That's what I was going to ask.
That's very much something that depends on the general status of the patient, how high up the bolus is, and how confident you are at removing a bolus. So in the beginning, when I started out, our hospital pathway at the time was that every bolus should be intubated. Uh-huh. Also, if you didn't know what the bolus was and how high it was. And that definitely gives you security of the airway, because there's nothing worse than if you remove it and it drops into the wrong hole, because then you have a problem. Then you really need to be quick. And usually boluses don't happen during the light of day. This is usually happens during a nice dinner at 7 p.m. Patients then try all sorts of maneuvers, like trying to vomit it up, trying to get rid of it. And then it's 10, and 10 o'clock is the start of the dead time in any hospital. And then it will take even longer. You maybe just have one nurse. You don't have a lot of personal. And that's where I'm always in favor of asking your friend from anesthesiology to help you, because no one will hear you scream in a far-off endoscopy unit where two people try to remove a bolus and it drops into the trachea. You really need to be very experienced in order to do that. So I think you need to adapt it to the time of day. You need to adapt it to how much staff you have. And you also need to be very, very secure having your airway secured.
Okay, so I assume when you have your airway secured, you're doing this probably in the operating theater and not in the endoscopy suite. But you, okay, so you have all that and you've gone in now and you're in there with your gastroscope. I assume you're using at least initially a diagnostic gastroscope. Is that correct?
It depends. If I'm really, really certain that it's a big, big bolus and that I need to have good suction, I also go in with a therapeutic one with a big channel to suck out mm-hmm. liquids and fluids and to really be able to maneuver. What I always attach also to have a little bit of security is a cap. Mm-hmm. So I can really spread out over the upper esophageal sphincter so I can see where I go and can also see the mucosa around the bolus, whether that's, you know, edematous, whether there's already bleeding, whether there's something going on. And that helps me a great deal. So either a diagnostic scope or from the beginning, a therapeutic one, but always with a short cap so you can really see what's going on. It also helps you to go in carefully to assess whether there's strictures or webs or something like that. So that is one of my tips and tricks that I always teach my registrars.
And the distal cap attachment can also help with suctioning, the actual bolus itself.
Yeah, it can help a great deal with suctioning and also with removing the bolus. You can also then use a larger cap. I sometimes use the big bell caps. If you need to remove it in chunks, that helps a great deal. Mm-hmm. So you can remove big chunks with that, with good suction, and the suction is generally better also with a therapeutic scope.
So let's talk about that. So you have the bolus there, you have your distal cap attachment onto your gastroscope. People sometimes now, it's become a little bit more in fashion to push the bolus through. Now, when I was starting out, we were told you never push, you always pull or try and grab onto the bolus and slowly take pieces out. What is your practice in terms of push and pull, and tell me about your go-to endoscopic accessories that you use to try and get that bolus out of there.
So if we're talking about a meat bolus, that also depends on how much there's in there. You can really have the full esophagus impacted. And then I have my internal algorithm. If it's, you know, a young patient with allergies and possibly EOE, I might go a little bit more careful. And also, if it's an elderly patient where I'm not sure whether there's a tumor, I'm also a bit reluctant to push. But this is something that it's very hard to teach. But that feeling of whether you can firmly, but not with brutal force, move the bolus along the esophagus and in the axis of the esophagus. That's something you develop over time. Sometimes you just compress the bolus and then you feel that you cannot go any further because there's that firm resistance. But sometimes you can just move it along the esophagus with a little bit of gentle pressure and then you're through. That's the ideal one. But if it's a venison bolus or a chicken bolus that has been there for a long time in an elderly patient with maybe a peptic stenosis, then sometimes you will have to resort to remove it orally. And then I usually try to get the bell-like distance gap and try to take chunks out to get visibility. I'm not worried of losing it somewhere.
Right, right.
I have a secure airway. I'm more reluctant if it's an awake patient. But if a sedated patient airway protection. Right. But in that scenario, you can just slowly and gently pull it out while keeping the stuff very close to your lens, and you can really remove big chunks. Sometimes you will have to use other devices like snares, and just to get a little bit of to compact it in a way that you can remove it, even if it's dry. You can use snares, you can use polypectomy bags, and that's very much something that you learn over time.
Yeah.
Some people, what's also an option if you don't have an anesthesiologist is to use an overtube, but I've become very, very selective in the patients that I use it with, because it can really cause big tears in your upper esophagus and in your upper esophageal sphincters. This is why I always start out also with a cap, because that gives me a feeling how sclerotic that upper esophageal sphincter is. I mean, the overtube protects your airway as well, but it needs to be very well handled, and you need to be aware that it can cause damage by putting it in there, because it's huge. It's pretty soft, but just inserting it can just split the esophagus open and give you pretty scary tears that you don't want to be there. Yeah.
Yeah. And if the patient, you know, is under general anesthesia when being intubated, you don't need the overtube. The other thing with the overtube, before you place the overtube, if they're getting moderate sedation, you also need to see where that bolus is, because if it's really up high, that's a problem placing an overtube.
Indeed. This is why you need to do a first look. You cannot just go in blindly with any device. So you need to plan it. You need to be sure what's in there, how big it is, how moist and juicy and fluffy or hard it is. It's all about how well the patient chewed is also quite important. And you need to take a history. I think it's very important for that. If it's been long ongoing and they've had, you know, repetitive bolus obstructions and they're old, then I'm always afraid that it's a tumor. And then I'm very, very reluctant to push.
Yeah, with snares, I personally will use mini snares, just because you're working in a closed space.
Yeah.
Like a 9mm size snare.
Yeah, I use a small snare, no big snares. Okay. No, nothing big that can hurt the esophagus.
Yeah, and what about like nets, like a Roth net or something like that? I personally don't use that, again, because sometimes they open up too big, but you can sometimes control the opening of those nets. Do you ever use those?
I use those, especially if it's a fluffy bolus and I need to compress it. I'm not a huge fan, I have to say.
Yeah, they can be problematic in this clinical situation. I agree with you.
They are brilliant for other things, but in that situation where you're really in a narrow tube, it needs to have careful maneuvering. But most of the time, suction in a cap will help you pretty well.
Okay, so we've got the food bolus out. Right? Everything's clear. And let's say you're able to visualize the esophagus at this point. And let's assume that you can actually get your gastroscope past whatever is there, whether it's a peptic stricture or whether it's a malignancy, or it has the appearance potentially, if it's a young individual, potentially eosinophilic esophagitis. But you've completed your exam, you've looked at the stomach, you've looked at the duodenum. I assume you do try and complete an upper endoscopy if possible. Is that correct?
If they have a protected airway, I do. Because if the stomach is still full with food, then I want to have a protected airway so that they don't aspirate on the last meters.
Very good point.
Of the investigation. So the protected airway is crucial for me.
Okay, so the esophagus is now clear. What do you do at this point? Do you just pull out your scope and say, okay, everything's done and we'll follow up this patient later? Or do you do biopsies? How do you further investigate at that point as to why did this happen in the first place?
So if it's a tumor, I take biopsies right away so that I have a quick diagnosis. With EoE, it's a little bit debatable, because there's some data that shows that you will not have as many eosinophilics in a stress situation like a bolus, but I usually do. I also document what I find pretty well so that the doctor coming after me knows what I thought. Sometimes it's also just a bloody mess because you've also created, if it's an EOE and you've gently pushed down the bolus, it can give you very, very scary esophageal tears. Usually it's not a perforation, but you need to inspect that very carefully. And this is something that I insist on, that you need to inspect the esophagus for problems that the bolus has created, like pressure ulcers, or that you have created, like esophageal tears that go through the muscle. You don't really want that, so that you can treat them appropriately and right away. Sometimes if the bolus has been in there a long time, you find a perforation after you have removed the bolus. We had such a case, patient with longstanding achalasia, had vomited, had a big bolus in his esophagus. We took out the bolus and we saw a huge perforation, like right at the GOJ. And then you have the opportunity, or you need to use your brain completely in a different way to try and fix that. And then timing is very important. How long has the mediastinum been exposed to the bolus? Do you need a surgeon? What do you do to manage the problem? Do you use a sponge? Do you use a stent? So a bolus is not just about getting rid of the bolus and putting it into the stomach. It's about assessing the esophagus
or
all the things that can happen in the worst case scenario. And I always do that very, very carefully, because that's the moment where you can still do something. If it's 48 hours later, it's a catastrophe. So really inspect the esophagus to look for problems that the bolus or you have created, because then that's the golden time to try and fix it.
So let me push a little bit further. So let's say that you do suspect maybe this is EOE. When you take the biopsies, are you taking the biopsies as you would in a standard EOE evaluation? In other words, are you taking, you know, four quadrant biopsies in the distal esophagus, the mid esophagus, and even today some would say you should also be taking it in the upper esophagus as well and putting them in three different bottles. Do you follow that same practice?
I try to. I'm going to say it diplomatically. I try to.
That's a good, honest answer.
If it's 2 o'clock in the morning and my nurse looks at me with big eyes and says, because then there's also the practical issues of taking a biopsy at 2 o'clock in the morning. These biopsies get lost.
Yeah.
These are the ones that get caught up in the hospital and you don't find any idea. But I try to take them. I try to get them evaluated as quickly as possible. And especially if there's a tumor, I want to know. With the EOE, I also try to take the biopsies. Not everyone does it, but I try.
All right, so let me ask you something else. Let's say that there is a suspected peptic stricture. Are you going to dilate it at that gastroscopy, or do you put them on a PPI and bring them back later? What's your practice, and what's recommended?
I'm going to say, if you pushed it down, you've already dilated it.
Correct, I agree with you. But what if you've just been able to pull it out and you really can't even get your gastroscope beyond this narrowed area? What are you going to do?
Then. You will, you know, if it's, it depends on the time and the staff you have and about security and the patient you have in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
If it's daylight and everyone is there, I would assess whether I can possibly make it a little bit bigger. But if it's in the middle of the night, I will probably put a tube down, feed the patient, give them PPI and reassess, because the whole esophagus is upset. After such a bolus event, it hurts. There's edema. You probably also overestimate the rate or how narrow it is, and then you might actually cause a problem. So I try always to be careful, give them PPI and reassess after 1 or 2 days. If it's really a stricture that I feel confident in dilating, I will do it during the day, but during the night, I will leave it for daylight time.
Post endoscopy management, anything beyond giving these patients PPIs?
Instructing them very carefully on what they can eat. I think that is the biggest question. That is always, that's something that comes first from the wards. Are they allowed to drink? Are they allowed to eat solid foods? This is very important. Watch out for pain. I think pain is a very important patient thing. If they're in pain, you might want to do a CT scan anyway. and actually tell them that they need to come back, even though that they're fine, because the problem might reoccur. And you need to go the full differential diagnosis of dysphagia there. Uh-huh. You might have to rule out a motility disorder if uh-huh. the esophagus is completely beautiful, and you might have to rule out achalasia. You might even have a normal esophagus and have EOE. So the brain needs to keep on working, and the patient needs to know that they have to come back for a second assessment, or you will not have solved the problem.
Listen, this was a great podcast on food impaction, and what we're going to do, this was so good that we're going to bring you back and do a follow-up on foreign body ingestion, because there's so much more to talk about.
I'm already looking forward to it.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. Now, before I let you go, I do want to find out a little bit more about you. What do you do aside from endoscopy? I'm a big sports fan. I still follow my American sports teams. Are you into sports? What does Henrietta Heinrich do when she's not taking out food boluses?
When I'm not taking out food boluses, I'm usually in the mountains. We have a little house there.
Ooh.
And we go hiking and skiing.
Wow.
So I'm in the mountains, enjoying the mountains and skiing and hiking and reading books.
Fantastic.
And enjoying the landscape.
Fantastic. Well, listen again, Henrietta, thanks for being here, and have yourself a wonderful day. Thanks again.
Thank you. You too. And thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Endoscopy Unplugged. If you found this podcast useful, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. To find out more about the European Society of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, for example, to browse our scientific publications, interact with our online learning portal, the ESG Academy, or learn about becoming a member of ESGE, visit our website, www.esge.com. And of course, your feedback is always valuable to us. So send us your thoughts via podcast at esg.com. Thanks for listening, and join us next time.